Exodus 24. The covenant confirmed. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, the 70 of the elders of Israel. You are to worship at a distance, but Moses alone is to approach the Lord. The others must not come near me, and the people may not come up with him." When Moses went up and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young Israelite men, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in bowls, and the other half he splashed against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with these words." Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of lapis lazuli, as bright blue as the sky. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God, and they ate and drank. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and stay here, and I will give you the tablets of stone with the law and commandments I have written for their instruction." Then Moses set out with Joshua, his assistant, and Moses went up on the mountain of God. He said to the elders, "Wait here for us until we come back to you. Aaron and Hur are with you, and anyone involved in a dispute can go with to them." When Moses went up to the mountain, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. For 6 days the cloud covered the mountain, and on the seventh day the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud. To the Israelites, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on top of the mountain. Then Moses entered the cloud as he went up the mountain, and he stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights.
Thank you very much, Chris. Let's keep that open as we work our way through it this evening. Let me pray. Loving Father, we thank you that you spoke to Moses on the mountain, and we thank you that you speak to us today through your word. Please would you be pleased to do that again this evening. Please would you give us ears that are willing to hear and hearts that are willing to receive all that you have to say to us today. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. What does it take to have a relationship with God? Christianity is more than just a set of rules, more than just an outlook on life. It's rightly described as a relationship with God. And that raises the question, what does it take to have that relationship? Some would say, not much. Your average man on the street probably thinks that God would be delighted to have him in. Church attendance has gone down in this country decade after decade. Surely God would be thrilled if I showed him just a little bit of interest one Sunday. After all, he's probably just sat here on his own, lonely. Even Christians, well, we take that relationship with God for granted at times. Just one part of our busy lives, something we'll appreciate when things are going well, but drop if things are going badly. Even something that we feel like we deserve after all the hard work we've put into it. We've paid our dues. We've done this for him. We've sat through thousands of sermons about him already. Well, today, I want to overturn that idea and see what an astonishing thing it is that God would enter into a relationship with the likes of Israel. And what an even more amazing thing it is, that God would enter into a relationship with the likes of us. One of the biggest messages from Exodus 19 is that we cannot approach God and live. Israel are at the foot of the mountain, and God keeps on saying at 19:12, if you'd like to just flick back to it, chapter 19, verse 12 says, "Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death." 19:21. "And the Lord said to him, go down and warn the people so they don't force their way through to see the Lord. And many of them perish." 19:24. "The Lord replied, go down and bring Aaron up with you. But the priests and the people must not force their way through to come up to the Lord, or he will break out against them." Even that first verse that we read again today in 24:1, even as it tells some to come near, it keeps them very much at a distance. "Then the Lord said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. You are to worship at a distance. Moses alone is to approach the Lord, but the others must not come near, and the people may not come up with him." What does it take to have a relationship with God? Well, the first answer that the passage gives is the unswerving commitment of the Lord. What it takes to have a relationship is the unswerving commitment of the Lord. And now, I do enjoy a really good wedding, and I particularly enjoy a wedding where I've played absolutely no part in either planning or paying for it. It is really nice just to turn up, isn't it, and enjoy everyone else's hard work. But we all know, don't we, when you go to a wedding, there's a lot of hard work that's gone on before it, right from day one, you might say. Now, I've got to be careful here in how I describe dating or courting as hard work. I'll just say it took a lot of hard work to convince Lucy that I would be a good prospect for marriage. Lots of hard work in dating and flowers and dressing smart and the rest of it. But it doesn't end there, does it? Some people put a tremendous amount of energy into the proposal with marching bands and diamond rings and planes writing in the sky as if the display is going to convince them to say yes. That's all before the stress and agony of preparing for the wedding day as well. One of the most stressful times in our life, so I'm told. So as I say, it's nice, isn't it, just to mosey in 5 minutes before the bride arrives, take a seat and enjoy everyone else's hard work. Now, Exodus 24 is like a wedding day. And if a marriage between two people has taken a lot of planning, then the marriage between God and his people has taken even more. It started on day one, didn't it? The day that Adam and Eve rebelled against God. God treated them with mercy and kindness. He let them live. He clothed them. He fed them. He led them with cords of kindness. It continued, as we were hearing in the video, with a promise he made to Abraham. If you will, that's like the engagement where God makes a promise with Abraham to bless and not to curse, to make him a nation more numerous than the stars in the night sky. It continued as the Lord blessed Abraham with children, and he protects his people through famine and through hardship. And we've seen all the way through the Exodus, all that it's taken to get Israel to this point. God's prepared Moses for 80 years before he sends him back to Egypt to lead them out of slavery. He brings plagues upon Pharaoh to convince him to let them go. He brings a Passover lamb to spare their firstborn son. He provides for his people through the desert. In fact, God's unswerving commitment to his people is summarized in chapter 19, verse 4. "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings to myself. It's one of those great verses that always reminds me of the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, and how those great big eagles swoop down and swoop the dwarves out of danger and carry them through the mountains of New Zealand, or through Middle Earth, really. This walk, which would have taken days up and down mountains, is passed in a few beats of a wing and a quick musical montage. A brief summary of the story shows, God has been committed to Israel from day one. He's poured out his commitment into them, into getting them to a stage where they're now ready to walk down the aisle. It's taken patience, promise, preparation, planning, plagues, Passover, provision and protection. And as we come now to the wedding day, God's unswerving commitment is again writ large all over the chapter. It's right there in verse 4. That's Moses, got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, these stones are to act, aren't they, as a permanent monument to the day. God is represented by the altar, and all of God's people are there, represented by the 12 stones, representing each of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, if, say, for example, on Lauren and Elias's wedding day, there was a big truck that reversed its way into the car park. I know it's a narrow entrance, but you can imagine it there trying to get round the corner. It parks up, and then a big crane were to lift off the back of it a several-ton monument, a sculpture, in fact, of Lauren and Elias gazing into each other's eyes, prepared on the wedding day, and we were to place it at the front of this church. Well, you'd get kind of an idea of what these stones are doing here. There wouldn't be any public record offices back in the day, but anyone walking past these stones for generations would come and remember this is the agreement that God had made with his people. God is writing in stone his commitment to his people. But not only does he write it in stone here, he also writes it in blood. In verses 6 to 8, we get the ancient equivalent of signing the register. In chapter 9, as I mentioned, God has been preparing his people for this. Each of them have washed their clothes, and they're now stood before the mountain, ready to meet with God. Moses and the mountain, and they're all stood there in their wedding finery. Those funny little hats for the ladies, the fascinators. All the gents are there in their smartest suit and tie. And then what Moses does, he brings a cow in from the back. He kills it, and he drains all this blood into a basin. Take quite a while, wouldn't it? There's quite a lot of blood in an oxen. Then he mixes it together with water, gets a bunch of hyssop, and he sloshes it all over the altar. And then he walks among the people, and he sloshes it all over them. All the blood getting in people's hair and clothes and mouths. It's quite a gory scene, isn't it? But that was the procedure for making a binding agreement back then. Just as we might sign a register, it's a little bit more efficient these days, isn't it? Or exchange rings that say, all that I have, I give to you. So it is with this blood. The blood is a sign of closeness, sprinkled on both the altar and on the people. The one blood now uniting two parties. It's a little bit like a blood oath, where you'd cut your hand and then press them together with the other person. The same blood now flows in our veins. Or maybe more like a wedding day, where two people not related by blood are signing a covenant that makes them closer than kin, one flesh together. In one of the prophets in Zechariah 9, chapter 11, the blood of the covenant acts like a signature to the document. God has bound himself in blood to act on behalf of his people. Zechariah 9:11 says, "As for you, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit." And there may even be a little bit of a warning going on with this blood as well. The animal was there to warn them what would happen if this covenant was broken. Now, one of the reasons why it's so gory is as if to say, may I be like this animal if I don't hold up my end of the agreement. So there we go. We've had the vows. We've had the signing of the register. And then in verse 10, well, there's the wedding breakfast as well, isn't it? Weddings are usually followed by a wonderful feast or a wonderful meal, which I always thought was just part of a party, part of a way of celebrating what's happened. But if you do a little bit of digging, you'll find that covenants in the ancient world were often followed by a feast, not just for a bit of a knees up, but as a way of representing all that the covenant had achieved. It had brought two parties together to eat and drink in fellowship without one party killing the other. And that's what's happening in 9 to 11. Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of lapis lazuli, as bright blue as the sky. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of Israel. They saw God and ate and drank with him. It's one of those scenes that just leaves you begging for more details. What exactly did they see? How did they see God and live? What did they eat? What's the significance of this pavement? What was it like to dine in God's presence? Were they able to speak to him? What did they say if they did? We just don't know. Perhaps it was just too rich an experience to put into words here. Or maybe Moses just wants us to focus on the important thing, that the two parties are eating together at peace. And we shouldn't skim over the significance of what's just happened. We haven't seen anyone this close to God since Adam and Eve were walking with the Lord in the cool of the day in Genesis 3. Since then, access has been strictly forbidden, barred and blocked by angels with flaming swords. God's messages have to be mediated through dreams, through angels, through fire and through smoke. And yet here, 70 Israelites, their elders are invited to dine with Yahweh, their God. They get a glimpse of his feet, a sight just too awesome to behold. What does it take to have a relationship with God? Well, it's taken, hasn't it? The unswerving commitment of the Lord. We can't take a relationship with him for granted. The Old Testament stresses the distance that stands between God and man and the extreme measures that are needed to bring them together. This wedding day is so choreographed because one false move will result in death. It's more like entering a nuclear reactor or a volcano pit than it is a loving wedding. Extreme caution is needed. Sinful humans cannot stand in the presence of a holy God without a huge amount of preparation. The man on the street is playing a dangerous game, aren't they? When they would assume that God would be pleased to have them show him a little interest. Or that when they reach the pearly gates, of course that there'll be just some spare room for them. No, 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 that's not how this works. God is being extremely gracious in extending an invitation to us now. But perhaps, maybe you're not like the man on the street. Perhaps you're the opposite. You're surprised that God would ever want you. And I hope you're reassured by this passage, by how God has pursued Israel. When there was nothing in its favor, and every reason why God should abandon them, but patiently and faithfully, he pursued them down through the years. That's just not how gods in the ancient world used to work. Usually you'd have to bow and scrape and buy yourself into a god's affections. Even then, they were fickle and hard to please and could leave you in a moment. The idea that God would bind himself to someone is just mind-boggling. I'm still astonished that my wife Lucy would marry me, and yet she did. How much more that Yahweh, the God of the universe, would pursue and make a binding commitment to Israel. Surely that gives us some hope that God would be kind towards us. The length that he'd go to have a relationship with us. And of course, we have even greater proof of that, don't we? We sometimes sing the hymn, "The Church is One Foundation," which rejoices in these lines. From heaven he came and sought her to be his holy bride, and with his own blood he brought her, and for her life he died. What does it take to have a relationship with the Lord? Well, it takes the unswerving commitment of the Lord. But secondly, it also takes the people's commitment to God, the people's commitment to the Lord, which we need to see that Israel willingly undertake. Three times they say, "I do," or "I will," pledging themselves to God. In chapter 19:8, the people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." Chapter 24:3. When Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Then down in verse 7, then he took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." It's important to notice there that Israel are willingly and freely entering into this covenant with full knowledge of what God expects. They've read all the terms and conditions. God hasn't buried anything away in Appendix D, subparagraph C, sentence 5. They're not coerced into signing, which is important, isn't it? Because this covenant carries with it consequences for disobedience. If God has forced them into this marriage, well, he would be grossly unjust to punish them for breaking it. But Israel freely, willingly, and gladly enters the relationship. Well, who wouldn't? The God of the universe is willing to be your God and to be your on your side. And so they sign the document in triplicate. "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." But even as they do so, we're holding our breath, aren't we? And wondering, will it last? How will it last? I wonder if they had doubts themselves. No doubt they were sincere enough in what they say, but all the time we've seen the Lord's unswerving commitment to them, well, we've seen more than a few hints of just how fickle his people can be. As God's been carrying them on eagle's wings, well, they've grumbled every single step or every single flap of the way, haven't they? Now, when Moses first goes to Pharaoh, Pharaoh makes their work harder, and instead of trusting God, they grumble and moan. When God brings them out of Egypt at the Red Sea, they're threatened by Pharaoh's armies, and they say, "It would have been better if we'd have died in Egypt rather than die in this desert." A few days later, when the food and water's running out, well, they repeatedly grumble and moan against God and against Moses. God has shown himself able to provide and protect for his bride, and yet Israel are acting like a child on the back seat of a car. Again, some of our favourite family holidays were up in the highlands of Scotland, and they were great once you got there. But the journey was agony and torture, and boy, did we let our parents know about it. We moaned and groaned. It would have been better to have been at home. At least there was enough food here, and we wouldn't have died of boredom along the way. Israel had a similar relationship, a tricky courtship with the Lord. At every bump on the road, they'd wanted to turn back. And whilst God's been patient so far, well, once they've signed on the dotted line, it's a different matter. There's no going back. Disobedience carries serious consequences. They'll share the same fate as that bull. May I be like this animal if I don't hold up my end of the agreement. Disease, defeat, death, they'll be banished from the promised land. The Exodus will be undone if they break this covenant in even just the smallest way. It's a little bit like in marriage. Before you're married, you are free to a certain extent, within reason, to leave an engagement and seek a relationship with someone else. But once you're married, there's no turning back. You bound yourself to them for better, for worse, in sickness, in health. You are one flesh, such that leaving them for another is now considered adultery. As they sign this covenant, it feels like they're dancing on the edge of a cliff. All we can do is hold our breath and hope for the best. But we don't have to wait for too long to see how it ends up. Just 40 days later, as Moses comes down the mountain on the very eve of their wedding night, we find that God's people have jumped into bed with another god. They're worshipping a golden calf. And so we're left with this tension. What's God going to do? How can God's unswerving commitment to his people be kept when they've repeatedly and deliberately turned their back on him and exposed themselves to his judgment? What does it take to have a relationship with the Lord that lasts? Well, Exodus 24 has already hinted at the answer. See, another purpose for the blood was washing things clean. Not only did the animal act as a warning for breaking the covenant, it acted as a substitute for those who had broken the covenant. Its blood could be shed instead of theirs. And so Hebrews 9:19 tells us that when Moses had proclaimed every commandment of the law to all the people, he took the blood of calves together with water, scarlet, wool, and branches of hyssop, and sprinkled the scroll and all the people. He said, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you to keep." In the same way, he sprinkled the blood of both the tabernacle and everything used in the ceremonies. In fact, the law requires that nearly everything be cleansed, be washed clean with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. The blood is there to clean the people of their sins, to cover over their iniquity. In one way, it's a token gesture, isn't it? Of course, the blood of a bull is not washing anyone clean. A bull can't die in place of a person. They're not worth that much, let alone the sins of many people. And yet Jesus' blood is different, isn't it? He's God's beloved Son, God himself. His life is of infinite worth, of infinite value. And so he can pay for an infinite number of sins. Jesus' blood can wash us all clean. And Jesus knows that. And willingly enters into a new covenant, a new agreement between God and his people, not the descendants of Israel, but anyone who would come. On the night that Jesus was betrayed, Jesus took a cup. When he'd given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine from now until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." What does it take to have a lasting relationship with God? Well, it takes the Lord's unswerving commitment to his people. The Lord's unswerving commitment to us. Not only in making the covenant, but in keeping the covenant for us. Providing the blood that binds us together, the blood that covers over our sin, the blood of his own dear Son, Jesus Christ. You might need to be reminded of that today. If, like Israel, you feel just how fickle you are in your relationship to God, how distant we can be from him at times. Well, we need to remember how close his blood has brought us. We are united to him by blood. All that is his became ours, and all that is ours became his, including our unfaithfulness, which he took and paid for on the cross. You might need to be reminded of that today if God still feels distant or disinterested. You might need to be reminded of just the lengths that God has gone to pursue a relationship with his people, to make you part of his bride, to make you part of his family. If the effort that he put into the wedding is any indication, well, then he's not going to give up on you now. No expense has been spared, not even his own beloved son. Romans 8:32 says that if God didn't spare his own son but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? You might need a reminder of that today if you're just a little bit afraid of the world and all that's going on in it. Even if you're just worried for the church and how it appears to be declining in the UK. Through it all, there is one thing that remains stable: the Lord's unswerving commitment to his people. In just a moment, we'll sing, "Great is thy faithfulness, O God my Father. There is no shadow of turning with thee." Each day the sun rises, doesn't it, and casts a long westerly shadow. At midday, that shadow has shrunk to nearly nothing, and then it stretches out towards the east in the evening. But not with God, not a shadow of change with him. Thou changest not, thy compassions they fail not. As you have been, you forever will be. God is faithful to his bride, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish. You might need a reminder of that, even if you already know this today. Because there's a sense, isn't there, in which we're not there yet. The covenant's been signed and sealed, but we're not yet up the mountain eating with the Lord. Of course, we share in the Lord's Supper, but that's just a foretaste of the great banquet to come. Revelation 19:9 says that we're looking forward to the wedding supper of the Lamb. It says, an angel says to John, write this, "Blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb." And he added, "These are the true words of God." Well, we need to be reminded, don't we, of the certainty of what's to come. God's already signed the register. He's already sealed the deal in his own blood. The ceremony's already taken place. The blood already sprinkled on him and on you. And even Jesus is looking forward to that day with certainty, when he'll drink new this wine in his Father's kingdom. Well, what does it take to have a relationship with God? It takes the unswerving commitment of the Lord and his Son.